There were two notorious pubs in those days, one opposite the other. One was called the Neptune and the other the Paragon. The Paragon was frequented by mostly by the ladies from Hessel Road, and the Neptune, I don't know where they came from anywhere. But the most popular with the ladies, of course, were the Scandinavians, who were very, very well paid because they got a lot of danger money. So they usually went off with them, not with Jack.
Any other memories of wartime Hull?
Not really. Talking of pubs, there was a pub called the Old English Gentleman, which is still there. I checked on it this time. And one of my boiler cleaners was a man, I suppose, well into his 50s, but he considered himself socially a cut above his mates. And he always frequented on his own. He never went ashore with anybody else. He always frequented on his own this pub, the Old English Gentleman. And he always smoked a certain brand of cigarettes. And in the middle of boiler cleaning, he would be there with his soot-covered face, with his saw, rather like a cavalier, like Laughing Cavalier, posing. And he'd take out a cigarette, and he would light it and blow smoke rings. And he would say, "Three castles handmade," which were H.O. Wills, I think, "Three castles handmade." That was one of my mates. But they were terrific characters, all of them, all the old boys who'd come back again.
Was this
The
pub
old
in George
stripers.
Street? Was this pub in George Street?
It's off George Street. It's now, well, it's in the same place it was, but all that area, I think you've got a circular road running just nearby now, which wasn't there in those days. And it's just by there. It's a kind of an open space, and it's on the corner of a road, and then there's an open space, and 100 yards away is the Etheldreda Mission still. It's now, I think, converted into flats. But the old brickwork, the terracotta brickwork, the narrow windows of the cabins in which the nuns used to be, and we took over, they're still there. So the shell of the building's exactly the same.
Did this job affect your health long term?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
How did your period in Hull come to an end?
I got a draft chit back to Portsmouth, and there I was given a draft chit to a cruiser called the Danae, Danae. This was a time when my father was dying, actually, and he was in his doctor cousin's cottage in a village called Shotley Bridge, which is about 13 miles from Newcastle on Tyne. And I'd put in for what do you
Compassionate
call,
leave.
compassionate leave. And I think it was because of that they sent me to the Danae, which was in fact on heading on Tyne in dry dock. She'd been doing a refit, and I was able to to come back every night to Shotley Bridge until my father died, and in fact until quite a long time afterwards. It became a bit of a joke with my cousins, who were extremely kind to me and very generous and hospitable, because I'd keep saying goodbye to them and thinking, well, we're going to sail, and for some reason or other it didn't happen, and I used to come back again. And the most notorious occasion, we actually were going to do our first engine room trials, engine trials, in the Tyne. I had been given the job, I don't know why, but I had been given the job as engineer's writer. And part of my job was, whenever we left harbour or came back, I had to stand in the engine room taking down the to log all the different revolutions and so on. So I was standing by the engineer commander when the order was given to start up the engines, and we started with the port engine, and immediately the throttle was open. There was a terrific noise, and the commander gave the order immediately to shut down. Eventually the engine room, the turbine casing of the port turbine was removed, and a remains or chopped up wrench was discovered, which had torn off the turbine, you know, absolutely ruined the turbines. The CID was called in. As the engine room writer had a little office, tiny little office, and I remember the bits and pieces of this wrench being placed on the desk there. We never discovered who did it, whether it was a mistake or whether it was sabotage. Through the galley, rumour was that we were going to the Far East, which was very unpopular. So it could well have been some disgruntled, even a stoker, I suppose, who had placed it there. But the man who took the can back was a chief ERA, who, in my opinion, was the most hard-working of all the ERAs that I saw. He was always had oil or was dirty, and he was obviously an extremely conscientious bloke, but he happened to be the last naval rating who was there before the casing was replaced, and so technically he had to take the can back. As far as my personal career is concerned, one day we eventually did our trials and left and went up to Scarpa, where we did the rest of our trials up there. As I said, I had been learning the ropes as a reporter before the war, and I'd also been going to night class at Pittman's in Southampton Road, doing shorthand and typing, and this was cut short because I was being called up. So I thought, right, I'm going to be on board this ship for a long time. As I said, we were probably going to the Far East. I thought I would polish up my shorthand and by doing a correspondence course. So one day I was in this little tiny office of ours, engineer's office, and I was doing this correspondence course, shorthand, when the commissioned schoolie poked his head in, I don't know what for, to ask some question or other, and he saw this hairy-ass stoker doing shorthands. He said, what the hell are you doing this for? So I explained. So he said, well, how long have you been a stoker? I said, oh, 3 years. And he said, well, why aren't you in the Press Division Admiralty? Never heard of it. And so anyhow, he explained what it was. And I slapped in a request straight away to see the commander, and after that, another request to see the captain. And nobody on board had ever heard of the Press Division. I think it was the jaunty who thought it was had something to do with the delivering the post or something to the ships. Anyhow, I was granted an interview in the Admiralty, and I made my own way from Scarpa down to the Admiralty. And there I was interviewed by a Commander Dylan Robinson, RN, who had been a peacetime brewer and had been called up again. And he explained to me what the Press Division was. It obviously was, it consisted of reporters, or it consisted entirely of men who had been on newspapers, mainly on Fleet Street, either reporters, photographers, or the actual staff in the Admiralty itself, which did all the sub-editing. The reporters did the stories. The stories came in, they were sub-edited, subbed in the Admiralty. They were then sent out, blue pens, or what do you call it?
Censored.
And after they were censored, they were then sent to the Ministry of Information, which of course was dubbed the Ministry of Disinformation. And they distributed it to the papers or to the media. So that was the Press Division, and the purpose was twofold: to keep, like I had been told during my interview way back in 1939 by Commander Rump, that the Army were getting so much publicity and it was time that the Navy got some because of the naval estimates which came up, and therefore it was important to impress on MPs the importance of the Navy. Ditto now, it was still important to counter all the publicity the Army and the Air Force were getting, particularly the Air Force. And so this is why the Press Division had been set up. Dylan Robinson told me that unfortunately he had just commissioned an official naval reporter, so that I was just too late. But the very next opportunity that arose, he would make sure that I would get the job. Meantime, I was to go back to the Daney, get transferred back to my depot, which was Pompey, Portsmouth, and wait there until I got the signal to come to the Admiralty. In fact, I went back to the Daney in the Scarpa, was there several weeks, and we sailed. And to cut a long story short, after calling in at Gib, Malta, Portside, Suez, Mombasa. It was only at Mombasa that the signal came through that I was to return immediately. I'd been promoted to sub-lieutenant RNVR, bracket special, and that I was to return by the shortest possible route. So that's how I got my meteoric promotion from stoker to sub-lieutenant.
Can you tell me something about the duties that you took up in the press division, please?
Yes, I did my first spill of duty at Harwich, and that was mainly covering light coastal forces, and any ships, and it was a matter of just going on board after the sun sunk over the yardarm and having a gin and orange with the in the wardroom, getting stories from the officers and then from the ratings, writing up the story. I went aboard with my official naval photographer. So we wrote up the story and we sent it back to the Admiralty. Most of them appeared in the London Evenings, but they were also sent to the local provincial papers because they wanted all the local stories about ratings, local ratings, of course, so that they get the stories for the provincials. And that went on until, I suppose it was May 1944, probably last few weeks, when my photographer, Jock Russell, and I received the signal from the Admiralty that we had to report at the Admiralty at some hour of 7 o'clock in the morning or something on such and such a date. And we thought, well, this is the balloon's gone up and this is definitely D-Day. So we turned up to the Admiralty and we got on a coach with a whole number of war correspondents. And we stopped in a huge manor house somewhere in Sussex. And I remember that the security was such that that there were notices we mustn't walk on the grass because our footsteps would be seen in the dew and by possible spy aircraft, Germans. It was then we were told that this was not D-Day, but it was going to be one of the rehearsals for D-Day, of which there were several. And it was called Operation Fabius. And sure enough, we were then coached down to a port, which to this day I'm not sure where it was, but I think it was somewhere on the Somerset coast. And oddly enough, this was the first time that I had seen landing craft. And I was absolutely fascinated by all these different craft. Because up till now, there had been no landing craft in Hull, none in Scarpa, none in Rosyth. The first time that I'd seen an LCT or an LCA or LCI or whatever it was. And I remember standing on one of these, I think it was an LCT, and there was a Canadian colonel standing by me. And I said, "Excuse me, sir, but what are all these craft?" And he said, "These aren't craft. These are tanks." And they were actually DD tanks. which were the camouflaged tanks, and the idea was that they should go into the assault, and when they beached, then the front came down and the tanks rolled off. Yeah, so that was the one of the rehearsals, and back to Harwich, and then the proper signal came, and I should point out, yes, there's one thing I think I should mention, that one of my the other official naval reporter who was on this Operation Fabius, when we went about 40 miles out into the channel, turned round and, quote unquote, invaded our own shore. And after we exchanged views, he says, "I don't like the look of this." He says, "I've no intention of going." Which struck me as very odd. Whether there was any connection, I don't know, but I happen to know him, and he was a bloke who had joined the British Union of Fascists, joined the Black Shirts, Moseley's lot, for his newspaper, which at that time supported Moseley, and only dropped supporting him after the business at Olympia. So it turned out that when D-Day came, there were only two official naval reporters to cover it. One of them was Sub-Lieutenant Playfoot, who went in with the minesweepers before the actual armada sailed, and the other was myself, who was on LCT 903, and so as it turned out, I was the only official naval reporter actually to land on the beach on D-Day itself.
Can you tell me what it was like, please?
We were due to touch down on the beach at H plus 90 minutes. I was on the bridge. The CO, it was his 21st birthday, so I was his senior by about 4 years, no, 5 years. Which gives you an idea of the ages of the commanding officers of these landing craft. We were transport, I think, I forget what we had, ambulances or something, and a whole lot of soldiers. They covered up with camouflage netting to start with. And only when we were about to land was the camouflage netting taken away. The LCT on both sides were damaged, one by shell fire and the other by the submerged mines, which were attached to what looked like truncated railway lines, which were sticking up out of the sand. And the idea being that at high tide they would just be covered and they would scrape the bottoms of the craft, which in fact happened to us. And also there were teller mines attached to them, teller being the German for table, and they were table mines attached to them. The craft next to ours hit a teller mine, but managed to beach and to all the men and materials got ashore. The other, I think, was hit by a shell, because in spite of the terrific bombardment mainly by our cruisers and by all the heavies, there were still gun emplacements holding out, and they were still pooping at us. And but all the craft, none of the craft actually sank, although they were holed. And in fact, when I eventually got back to the Admiralty, there was a chap from Lloyd's Register who asked me to do a story on just this, about how our craft, because they were so well compartmented, like egg boxes, so many of them remained afloat in spite of the fact that they were holed. So I did this special article on that, I remember, after I got back. Anyhow, on D-Day itself, we landed our troops and then started pulling out. We pulled offshore quite a way when we started taking in water, and the CO said we had to abandon ship. Most of the men got off onto another, I think it was an MTB, which came came aside. It didn't sink, and we managed to actually beach again. My problem then was, I'd not been given any instructions as to how I was to get my story back again, and how I was to get myself back, having been stuck on the beach. And I remember wandering up and down and asking various craft, and of course there were a lot of beach craft there. Eventually, I can't actually remember this. But it was by a series of one or two craft that I managed to get a craft which was actually going to cross the channel back again. And my last view of the Normandy shore was of a group, I don't know, of about scores of German prisoners, the first Germans I'd seen during the war. Most of them that had their trousers stripped off so that they wouldn't run away, presumably. And it was quite cool. It was quite a cool evening. And they were there shivering on the shore as we pulled away. That was my last sight of Normandy on D-Day.
Which beach had you gone into?
It was... what was it?
Sword or Gold?
It was Sword. It wasn't the furthest one. It was either Sword or Juno. It was the actual beach was called King Red.
Well, that identifies it.
Yeah, that identifies it. It was King Red Beach. And the sector is right on the edge, either of Sword and then came Juno, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. But it was definitely King Red, and it was 8 plus 90 that we were supposed to land, but it was a good bit after 90 minutes. It was, I think, we were about an hour late probably before we actually touched down because of the opposition. Oh, yes. What I didn't tell you was that after the Afridi, I was reported missing. And my unfortunate parents got this telegram to say that I was missing. My father was already rather a sick man, and my mother was very delicate also, so it was a bit of a shock for them. What had happened was that when I had been taking the wounded onto the Imperial, there'd been one of our... Well, it'd been Jimmy the One and another, and a rating, who had been making a list of members of our crew, the Afridi's crew, who had come onto the Imperial. And they must have taken down my name or ticked my name off or something. And then, of course, I'd gone back onto the Afridi, and